You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of December 18th, 2013, and it's Goaty Part 2, The Goatening.
Everybody, this is the Experience Points podcast, and my name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Albor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It's a serious but not humorless conversation about video games.
Yep.
Goaties are so nice, we gotta do them twice.
Oh, hey, you're like a lyrical genius now,
that's,
Scott.
That's
like
me. So, last week, it was Games of the Year, our favorite Games of the Year.
Yep.
We don't get too far into lists around these parts, but every once in a while, we indulge. We have a kind of ill-defined list of the finest games of the year, as committal as we can possibly get without being super committal on it.
Yep.
But George and I decided that most of the games that took up our time, both in terms of playtime and in terms of just analytical brain power,
yes,
possibly words as well, were games that did not make the Games of the Year list.
That's right. For one reason or another, they were either fundamentally flawed or they just didn't achieve some sort of criteria that was set in our own mind for Game of the Year. Yep. And a lot of these games made a lot of other people's lists.
Yep.
And also, there were some lists that clearly didn't include these. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we mentioned last week this has been a strange year for us, but I think it's been a strange year for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been an odd year for video games.
Like, there are certain games that I was shocked to see on not just one or two lists, but on some of the biggest lists out there.
Mm-hmm. And then, conversely, games that are just nowhere to be found.
Yep.
But, so, you know, with that in mind, we wanted to take a look at some of those that we passed over. Because, again, they're probably some of the more interesting games. We just didn't like them as much for some reason or another. So we'll kind of swap back and forth like we did last time. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
I'll go ahead and start.
Okay.
Why don't I start?
Yeah.
So, we talked about this on a debrief, and I think if you're curious to know how mixed of feelings we had towards the game, you should listen to that. And that game is The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah.
This is a game, I don't know, and I think this is true for all of the games on my list, and I'm sure some of the games on your list.
Yeah.
These are games where I tend to think about them a lot afterwards, and I'm not entirely convinced that I gave it a good eye. Like, I'm starting to wonder if maybe I should revisit these.
Ugh.
I mean, I know that's not a pleasant place to put myself.
I know.
Because I have to play the entire game again, but, you know, The Last of Us didn't make my list because I think the act of playing is not actually all that fun.
Yep.
There's a lot of really big problems when I was playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and this kind of relates to how I've been thinking about my favorite films of the year as well. And that is, there's been a lot of really good movies, but there are some that are standing out and I can't stop thinking because they do just a few things so different.
Mm-hmm.
They do things that make everything else look bad. And The Last of Us does that with its story and with its voice acting.
Yep.
And it's not so easy to say, oh gosh, you know, The Last of Us isn't really good because the gameplay kind of sucks or there's certain parts that I didn't really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think back on it and I keep thinking, but you know what? No one has done a story that is so thematically resonant in a way that turns what is normal in not just video games, but what is normal in pop culture and storytelling and mythology and makes it ugly in the way that The Last of Us does.
Yeah.
You know, people have compared it to The Road, and that's a really apt comparison because The Last of Us is asking us, narratively speaking, to like re-examine some of the things that we value and think, in an extreme scenario, those things are totally messed up and fucked up and horrible, potentially.
Yep.
In a way that not even, I think, The Walking Dead does.
Yeah.
Or maybe The Walking Dead isn't brave enough to do.
Yeah.
So I think, again, it's something that I think was really important for me and continues to be important because I keep thinking about it and I haven't even played the game in months.
Yeah. I'm also surprised at just how many lists it's also showing up on people's lists who are, in my mind, kind of much more focused on, like, I don't know, systemic excellence in a way, which is shocking to me because I found that was like the weakest aspect of the game.
Yeah,
I've actually heard theories like bandied around where like maybe you should play it on hard or extreme because
extreme,
whatever it is, extreme Last of Us, like
the lastest
of us. I mean, because apparently then it makes you think about the encounters more and you're less Rambo like. I mean, whatever. Like, there's been arguments back and forth, but people were like comparing it to like, I don't know, people were comparing it to like the Paragons, you know, like Dishonored or Thief or something, and it was like, what? Like, what game were you playing? You know, like, what was going on?
I mean, if anything, it's a better argument for the BioWare method, which is play it on the lowest difficulty and just skip it.
That was the other argument I heard people say. But like if you're going to do it, either play it with minimal, like, gameplay challenge or maximum gameplay challenge, because in the middle you're just in a bad spot, which is interesting, but it's kind of a rough thing to ask the players to do.
Like, that's definitely true.
But I do agree with your thing where, like, at the end of that, and, you know, we'll be careful with spoilers, but, like, at the end of that game, you know, it brings back, like, the idea of what an anti-hero actually is to, like, being a realistic thing. It's not like, oh, Wolverine's an anti-hero because he's, like, says...
Because he's angry all the time.
Yeah, he's angry and he stabs people. But, like, this is someone who's, like, a protagonist of the story who does things that you understand why they're doing it, but they are not good things.
Yeah.
You know, like...
And maybe there is no good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the story is excellent.
The other thing that really stands out is just the environmental design and art of it.
Yep.
It is a stunning game to play.
Yeah.
The way that they take Philadelphia and certain iconic parts of I think it's Philadelphia, right?
Boston? It was Boston, and then they went on the road.
They went to Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They made their way across,
But the way that the landscape is changed is just so gorgeous, and it's set up in a way that doesn't feel like I'm in a level that is discreetly created for my navigation in the game space. Mm. There are a couple levels like that.
And early on, too. I think it gets better as it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the scene in the winter when she's, like, hunting the deer, you know, like, there's all these, like, little environmental scenarios that just feel so good and so right. And in that moment, I think it makes others look bad because it doesn't seem like, I'm sure what they did took a lot of effort.
Yeah.
But there are people who clearly they try, but they're not trying hard enough.
Well, it comes off as so naturalistic.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the point, right? It feels like a lived-in and realistic world in a way that a lot of games don't, even when it's clear that they've tried very hard to achieve that.
Yep.
So, you know, my hat's off to Naughty Dog or for it, but,
But, yeah, I mean, at this point, just go full that direction. Like, forget the gunplay. Forget it. Yep. Like, they've done it with Uncharted 3 times in a row. It's our same criticisms hold true for everything. And I feel like The Last of Us is even more extreme.
Yeah.
Like, I would be interested to see their take on something that is much more like Gone Home or Dear Esther or something.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they should make us some really short. Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, DLC. I don't know. Okay, anyway, we're getting long. But this is the point, right? Yeah. Like, we end up taking so much time thinking about these.
All right, well, let's transition to one that won't spark as much discussion.
Okay.
A little indie darling, little engine that could game called Bioshock Infinite.
Okay, that's on my list as well, actually.
Yeah, I knew that was going to be something because we did a big, long podcast about it, wrote some stuff about it, did not make either our games of the year list. Yeah.
You know, there's a moment there's several moments in Bioshock Infinite that stand out of like, whoa, they're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go about doing all this other crap that I'm used to and is uncomfortable and not great and all of that stuff. But there are times like when you are in it, when you're playing Bioshock Infinite, and I'm just going to do some slight spoilers for the game.
Yeah.
But when you realize that you're in Rapture,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you realize that time is all, you know, wimbly, mimbly, or whatever about in Bioshock Infinite.
Yeah.
It's kind of breathtaking.
Oh, yeah. There are scenes, again, like in The Last of Us, where just amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, just amazing set pieces.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you wrote a good article, or maybe we talked about it, maybe both, about the way that Elizabeth is portrayed and the way that her life is almost described and detailed as sort of this men enacting their agency upon
mm-hmm.
her,
mm-hmm.
And how opening rifts is almost an empowering experience for her in that way.
Yeah.
All that stuff is really great, but it's just, there's so much other crap that it's with.
Yeah. Well, and on both sides of the equation, I would say, like, I feel like, so there was this good article by Tevis Thompson,
mm-hmm.
where he basically, like, outlays, like, I don't know, he has, like, 10 major points or something, and he, like, calls BioShock Infinite, like, the worst game of the year.
Wow.
And his argument is actually pretty good. We should link to it. But on both sides of the equation, in terms of, like, the narrative and the mechanical stuff, but, like, the mechanical stuff, I feel like, is basically, if you like the type of environmental exploratory, like, looking glass heritage games, then you know what you're getting into either way. Yeah. You're going to be scrounging, you're going to have your vigors, you're going to have your guns.
Yep.
You combine them in a way that may be interesting to you or maybe will be boring to you depending on what you like. But it's definitely not, you know, it's not revolutionary, I would say.
But on the other side, though, like, how many games talk about the Trail of Tears?
Yeah, none. Like, I mean, big AAA games anyway. Yeah. And, like, how many games put so much thought into their soundtrack?
Yeah.
And how many games, you know, have, you know, direct allusions to, like, American imperialism?
Yeah. Or even their own oeuvre of other games.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But then, you know, there are the other criticisms where both the colonizers and the oppressed are set pieces for, you know, Levine and company's larger argument.
Yeah.
You know, there's the kind of meaningless violence or just kind of hyper violence that doesn't really mean anything arguments.
The, like, unnecessary and wasteful commitment to neutrality, which is just kind of pointless.
Yeah. It's definitely, I feel like it says more about video games than ultimately it says about history or culture.
Have you played Burial at Sea yet?
Not yet. I plan on it because it seems like it's pretty neat, but, like, I have not played it yet. Do they continue? Like, have you played it already?
I have. So it's only part one of two.
Right, it's part one.
It feels quite short, so it's interesting to see. And in many ways, it just feels like more BioShock Infinite, but in BioShock. But, I mean, again, this is one of those things, I think, similar to The Last of Us, where DLC experiences or tiny story bits might tell us something more about, you know, their approach to game design or even in regards to games as a whole. I don't know. I think it's something that will be interesting once things have wrapped up to sort of relook at BioShock Infinite as a package that includes these other little pieces and stories.
Yeah. I don't know. I want to say, like, one more thing about BioShock Infinite, but I don't know how to say it without, like, sounding too much like an apologist. Like, the feel of BioShock, like, they get the feel of what, like, an American zealot looks like, you know, like, kind of the modern prophet.
Yeah.
You know, that
you're talking about the, what is his name? The old man.
Right. Comstock.
Yes,
yeah.
Comstock.
Yeah. I mean, he has kind of a Jim Jones, Joseph Smith, like, you know, this is a guy who sees himself biblically in a non-biblical time, but is trying to argue that they still live in biblical times. Like, it's, and again, it's kind of that kind of country, that prairie preacher archetype in American culture that I feel like is really hard to define. I mean, historians have done it better than I am doing it right now, but, like,
prairie preacher is pretty good. I like that.
You know, like,
that's
the guy,
a good analogy.
Yeah, I mean, it has this very truthful tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is someone who lives in a industrialized society, but is trying to fix everything, including humanity and his religion. He's purifying things at the same time. Like, just the way and the way that the iconography kind of combines the, you know, the modern architecture with the classical architecture inside of it. It also has the religious stuff all over it. It also has the explicitly tied to, like, race, you know, hierarchy of culture. Like, all that stuff is, like, it just feels so much like American society to me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't...
American society today or, like, the mythology and history of American society?
Both. I mean, you drive around the country and you will see people, you know, you will see basically prairie preachers. Like, you know, there are people that are flinging around rattlesnakes right now.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like that...
Well, it's nighttime, but, you know, indoor rattlesnake flinging.
No, I mean, like, that is a real thing that continues to happen. Like, and I don't necessarily know if it goes out of its way to explain and or justify it to anyone whose life experience that has not included that tone from birth.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
if you're not dialed into that weird undercurrent of American culture, I could see how a lot of the stuff just feels weird and arbitrary and pointless.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the kind of strange, like...
No, yeah. You're right, man. It's yeah. weird stuff.
It is, but gosh, what it says about video games is even better.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they've justified making a million Bioshocks or making no Bioshocks.
Yeah.
Based on the way that it ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, next on my list is... I'm going to cheat here.
Okay.
This is cheat. Four games.
Let's cheat. Whoa.
And I haven't played a single one of them.
Because these can be good... These can be still good games.
Isn't yeah.
It? Yeah, like...
I haven't played any of them.
Okay.
But the reason I think I want to talk about them is because I've still thought about them a lot. They're on a lot of people's conversations.
Uh-huh.
I've had numerous conversations about the quality of these games, and I've played a couple here and there.
Uh-huh. I've finished them.
No, it's just like, you know, taste tests or whatever.
Okay, but Barbie Dreamhouse.
Barbie Dreamhouse, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Ride to Hell Retribution. Yeah. what is that, Aliens versus Predators game?
Yeah, Colonial Marines.
Colonial Marines. Yeah. No. So it's Animal Crossing.
Oh, okay.
Pokemon.
Yeah. Okay. I see where this is going.
A Link Between Worlds
yeah.
uh-huh. and Super Mario 3D World.
Okay, yeah.
So these are all major Nintendo releases, mm-hmm. And I haven't played any of them. Animal Crossing, Pokemon... Pretty different. Mm-hmm. Super Mario 3D World, Link to the Past, pretty different.
We recently played a Pokemon game, though.
We did.
Yeah, last year sometime.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I forget what it was, though.
Blue, yeah, ice.
It was maybe. Pokemon.
It was a color.
Yeah.
It was a Pokemon game. But I think what's interesting to me is that a lot of the conversations that I've had with people have been about how these games have been some of the best games of the year. And mm-hmm. they appear on a lot of people's lists.
Yep.
You know, Animal Crossing showed up on a lot of people. Super Mario 3D World, I've played a little bit at work, and it's amazing. It's really good.
Well, I mean, it's by the Mario Galaxy
right.
guys.
Right, I mean, of like, course it
yeah,
is. Yeah,
yeah.
And there's still some issues with, like, you know, four-player co-op can feel like a strain because we're all pushing and pulling for space. People can mess with me in ways that I don't like to be messed with.
Luigi, don't play that.
Hey!
Yeah.
Just because it's your Luigi yeah. doesn't mean you have to be up in my shit. But I don't know. The reason I want to talk about them is because I think that we're in a stage where the environment for those games is so healthy right now. Like mm-hmm. if you want to play them and play those types of games, there are so many out there like it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have such a good time. But yeah. I still don't own a 3DS and I still don't own a Wii U.
Yeah.
And I'm missing out on it. And I'm wondering if missing out on those games is somehow missing out on some of the best parts of the year. Are these games indicative at all of what's to come, or are they still only being appreciated because they carry with them so much nostalgia baggage?
Yeah. I mean, the Idle Thumbs guys have been talking about this recently because Jake is obsessed with Super Mario.
Yep.
But, I mean, they made this point where, like, Nintendo is perennially screwed because, like, people want the same thing over and over again from them.
Yeah.
Except when they get it, they complain that it's the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
You know? And and so it's like, I feel like they're now at this point where they went a few of these games, like A Link Between Worlds and Mario 3D World, like, they hit this sweet spot where they are just different enough that they're still, like, something new to people, but they have the, you know, the spirit, whatever that is, of the games that came before them. So I feel like it probably wouldn't blow your mind if you played them.
Yeah.
But they are probably some of the better... They're probably indicative of some of the more, like, both innovative and traditional things that Nintendo's good at. You know, probably, like, a good representation of what Nintendo is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting that they didn't make your list either. I mean, presumably you haven't played this. Neither of us own a 3DS.
Neither of us have a 3DS, 3DS or a Wii U.
Do you see yourself buying a 3DS or a Wii U anytime soon?
Oh, man. Every time I go off on Amazon, like...
you are, like, inches.
Yeah, like, my mouse is just hovering over a 3DS. I'm like, oh!
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty cheap now. And
don't say that.
That Zelda bundle, too.
Ooh, that golden 3DS XL.
It is pretty hot.
I'd be the coolest person on the train. Actually, you know what? That's the hilarious thing, too. When I'm out and about, I'm seeing more and more 3DSs.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, a Vita, surprisingly enough, but, like, I do see 3DSs, and people are playing Zelda and Animal Crossing.
Yeah, those two.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's what I see when I'm around. So, like, I don't know. It just, it's tempting. I guess it's just
It feels like this is some sort of weird biodome. Like, it's a whole thing separate on its side that if you want, you could sustain yourself in that ecosystem all on your own.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you only cared about specific games and, you know, weren't there for the media experience or whatever, and you just wanted to play really great games, I mean, and you wanted a quote-unquote next-gen console, why wouldn't you get a Wii U?
Yeah.
You know? What are you going to play? Like, Assassin's Creed 4, I mean, you can play that anywhere. Like, yep. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's an interesting time.
Why would time. You, all right? Oh, jeez. Oh, I've been playing it, actually.
That didn't make our list.
No.
Surprisingly enough, actually, I feel like it kind of came out late in the year for everyone, but I hear that Assassin's Creed 4 is actually a pretty good Assassin's Creed game.
I'm playing it right now, yeah. And I don't know, man. I think I might be done. Mm. I think I might be...
You mean after only 8 games? You're...
After so many Creeds.
This Creed has finally run its course? I mean, I guess. It just seems like maybe people hated Assassin's Creed 3 for some reason.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I'll pirate it up some more.
Okay.
What else made your list?
Okay. Let's. We'll go to the other end of the pool, the more independent end of the pool. One of the games that I liked a lot, it just kind of... got edged out by one of the games on my list was The Swapper.
Oh, yes. So I actually gave that serious consideration as well.
Yeah.
That's probably in my top 5.
Yeah, if I could expand the list to 5, it would easily be 5. Yeah. Or 4.
What's funny enough is I consider The Swapper almost like The Last of Us in that, gosh, there's a lot of sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
In games. There are not a lot of good sci-fi stories in games.
Yep.
The Swapper is easily one of the best.
Yep. Definitely. And also the best puzzles too. Like I really like the puzzles a lot. You know, it's this game where you can make clones of yourself and then transfer your consciousness in between the clones.
Yep.
And the gameplay possibilities and the sci-fi dorkiness of that are just, they're just great companions to each other. Yeah,
totally. And you talked about it earlier on another podcast episode, but the design of the world in almost the papercraft way, but it doesn't come off as trivial or not real at all. Even though your spaceship is made out of like a soda can or something, it looks legit like a spaceship too.
Yeah.
So they managed to bridge these two different aesthetics that I don't usually think of when I think of that indie space, right? Mm-hmm. Which is something that looks cared for and made with great detail and attention, while also something that feels 100% environmentally like rich and thematically resonant in that way. For something that's so dark, like it is a dark and unsettling game.
Yeah,
but it manages to use some of the same tactics that like Little Big Planet does,
and also like not a, it doesn't go out of its way to be super violent. Like its horror is mostly psychological. Like it is like the unsettling nature of what is a person.
Yeah. I would love to see more games take the concept of making you feel unsettled by the very act of playing more. Not in the sense of, oh, this is so weird, it's gross, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I guess Papers, Please in some way, but even Papers, Please is about the setting, right? But the act of like the story and what you do now suddenly has meaning because of the narrative twist.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah. Yeah, the only reason why I was flip-flopping between that and Brothers, and the reason why I picked Brothers was because of the... Because
it was on my list.
It's because of the control input. Like, I thought the novelty of how you controlled Brothers was a bit more surprising to me, and therefore... But, like, other than that, like, The Swapper is, like, almost a perfect game in that weird way, where, like, it does exactly what it's set out to. It doesn't overextend itself. It's clever, and I don't know, it's just there's almost nothing to find fault with in there. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
well, I'll continue the indie trend.
Yeah,
and I'll talk about a game that I kind of forgot about actually until my coworker today mentioned it as one of his games of the year, and that's Dive Kick.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
So this is the fighting game, the two stick fighting game that is surprisingly rich.
Two button
yes. Not two stick, there's no sticks,
no sticks.
Just the one button. Two buttons. So one button jumps, the other button kicks, and you jump and then you kick.
Yeah.
You can't even move around. There's no left, right, you can't duck, you can't block, none of that.
Yeah.
Diving and kicking, that's all you've got. Yeah. But within those two buttons, you have a really rich experience because people have different trajectories and they've managed to distill down what a fighting game is into these sort of core elements of positioning.
Yeah.
But even above that, one of the reasons I think it's so interesting is that it's a game that is... not for you. It's not even for me. Like, it is for the fighting game community.
Yep.
It's full of these inside jokes for the fighting game community. Yep. I liked it, but I have no problems if you don't.
Yeah.
Because why would you? Like, it's not made for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about things like Dark Souls or, you know, other games that feel unforgiving or feel as though they're not, you know, they're targeting a particular audience. And Dive Kick is an adult, mature niche game that is designed specifically for a community, and a community that is already not a very welcoming community to begin with.
Like the fighting game is definitely has some you know, upsides and downsides to it. But like you were saying, this is like so many in, like how many other games have so many in jokes where like every character is an in joke. Like,
yeah, every animation is an in joke.
Yeah.
Like the things that they're wearing and the way that they like run away and all sorts of stuff is totally part of that one big joke. And it's also just super fun. So, like, I found myself constantly playing it shortly after release, and we played it at work, and it'll continue to be a game that I will pop out for parties and things like that. Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's just so interesting in that it's not something that will ever make my list. It's not something I'd recommend to everybody, but it is something that I think is very unique and special for this year.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I wrote a post about, like, getting back to basics. Like, there was a few games this year that did that, and, like... We even talked about, like, what is the basic version of a MOBA? And we were like, oh, maybe Awesome Knots or something like that. Or, like, you have two towers and you're just, like, fighting it out. Like,
well, there's a mobile MOBA now.
So
it's, like, turn-based.
I mean, yeah, like, people are just trying to, like, scale back and scale back and scale back. And, like, that's what Dive Kick was. Like, it is almost all about the metagame. Because you're, like, trying to figure out what moveset your character has, what moveset your opponent has, and then you're trying to outthink them, basically. Because, like, no combos. You don't need to memorize anything.
I
would actually be happier if it was less complex, because there are special moves you can do.
Yeah,
and there are, like, and the characters are quite different in their movement.
Yep.
I would be even more interested to be, like, to see something, like, almost, I don't know, like a Ryu versus Ken style thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That was like kind
fewer
of...
fewer characters?
Yeah, like, or,
they
do, like...
they have it. It's called Killer Instinct.
Oh, snap! Combo breaker. God, I was going to say one other thing about that. I forgot what it was, though. In terms of like, in terms of like welcoming people into the fighting game genre, no matter, even though it's like super in jokey, it distills why people like fighting games.
Yeah,
it's about positioning and it's about thinking about your opponent.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, what was weird to me is I tried to get a lot of people to play Dive Kick, like a lot of, because I was convinced, and every other person liked it, and every other person didn't like it.
Yeah.
And Activision was like, oh, I don't really feel like ever playing this ever again. And I kept being like, I don't know why. I don't know why they wouldn't want to play this. Clearly, this game is awesome.
Yeah.
But you know, I think after thinking about it more, I don't know. I think I get it. And that's okay. I think that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Should I do some quick hits?
Yeah, let's do a... We'll do a couple fast.
Because there's one big elephant in the room that we haven't talked about yet.
Well, let's talk about the elephant then.
Oh, okay. Well, Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is the elephant.
See episode 251 or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, thankfully, we did talk about the elephant.
Yeah.
And what an elephant it is.
So after several weeks of not playing it, have you thought about it at all?
Yeah, actually quite a bit. Today, I was talking with my coworkers about Game of the Year, and they suggested we talk about, for one of the other podcasts we do for my job, and they talked about GTA being one of the most disappointing games of the year.
Interesting.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I thought it was interesting, one is because, okay, I could see that. Let's, you know, hey, another chance to talk shit about GTA 5.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, I don't know. I don't think that it would be a disappointing experience, because I don't think that you can expect anything but what we got.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we had these huge expectations, but once they revealed the trailers and the characters, it's kind of your own fault if you didn't bring those into
life.
Yeah,
I guess that's it. I think, and maybe that's one of the reasons I think GTA 5 is so interesting, is that within its heart, within its concept of an open world in which you can interact and change things, and it's about the real world, there's hope for a game that is fucking awesome.
Yep.
If there's a game somewhere in GTA's still beating heart that is so much more reflective of what we all want out of it.
Yep.
And I think No Man's Sky, that trailer that everyone was like shooting themselves over recently, is also shining a light on that glimmer of hope that we all have for an open world game that will change our lives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you play a game like GTA 5 and you're digging through all this other rubbish, but you have that moment where you're like, I think I see it. I think I see it just around the bend.
Yeah.
It's hard not to fall into that more, right? Like, it is literally one of those wisps where it shows a glimmer of what might be possible and what might be really, really compelling.
Yeah. I mean, it's stuck in my head just because of the environments and the soundtrack, to be quite honest. Like, it's, again, it's one of those things kind of like Naughty Dog.
I know,
like,
how much you love your early 90s hip-hop.
I mean, God, that radio station is so amazing. Like, but, I mean, just the... it makes me think about, again, like Naughty Dog, what would happen if Rockstar scaled back its scope and said went dense instead of broad?
Yeah.
Because, like, come on, like...
But could they? Like, what does that even look like?
I don't know. I mean, it's just... It's never been more apparent after playing, like, the Saints Row games that, like, I don't know... Like, GTA games have almost ceased to be open-world games to me. They are now GTA games.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many other open-world games these days that it's not special anymore in the way that Grand Theft Auto 3 was when it first came out.
Yep.
I mean, now they're just all... They're kind of like Zelda games. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of know what you're getting when you're playing a GTA game. First, you get the boomerang. Then you get the hookshot. Yeah.
And then you stab a guy. Yeah.
With that hookshot. Yeah.
Hey, Trevor.
Yeah. If Trevor...
Take this Glock, you'll need it.
If Trevor was hearing, like, Navi, like a fairy, like, around in his head, like, shut up!
And well, someone needs to redub the entirety of GTA with Navi's voice.
That would explain all of his behavior.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, maybe not all of his behavior. Well,
some of his behavior. That's our GTA. That's our second GTA rant. Yeah. Any others that we want to throw in there?
Can I talk about Android Netrunner again? I talked about it last week.
This is a video game podcast.
One thing I didn't mention last week is...
I was going to talk about League of Legends.
Oh, good. Well, we'll talk about that too. Well, I mean, this is related. This is related. Yeah. And I think that I'm in an era now where it's easier and easier for me to appreciate small but consistent changes in my gaming experience.
Like League of Legends.
Like League of Legends and Android Netrunner. Every month, there's a release into the wild, and I like it, and I look forward to it, and I'm excited about it, and I find myself going looking for spoilers.
Yeah.
And I do that for League of Legends as well.
Yep.
And I'm not looking for spoilers because, oh, gosh, I really want to revolutionize my deck. I'm going to min-max the shit out of it now that this card is out or whatever.
Yeah.
It's that with these small, subtle changes, there's a dynamism now that is always on the horizon. Like, there's a sense of... both like trepidation and excitement because things can change.
Yeah.
And I think that this past year, and certainly this past few months with Netrunner, I've increasingly come to this point where I feel like that's what I want more out of games, be they board games or card games or video games.
Yeah. I was going to say pretty much the same thing because like it's hard to call, League is like the game of the year, but like it still is probably like that and Dota are two of the most interesting games because they are the kind of less odious version of games as a service.
Yep.
You know, like, just like how football and basketball and baseball all have rule tweaks every year, like, these games are having rule tweaks every couple months or whatever, and I mean, they're just fascinating, like, the cultural impact that they have is fascinating, and, like, the design implications, and, like, you know this type of stuff's gonna work its way into, like, single-player stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, so it's... that sort of thing, like
esports,
the esports side of things, it's for sure gonna work its way into like the more traditional game.
Yeah,
just like the rise of like RPG elements has worked its way into pretty much every game. Like you can easily see something like that happen. So I thought it was interesting for the same reason. Yeah. Plus, we're like pretty much experts on MOBAs this year, so
we are basically
pretty
MOBA.
Good.
I'm going pro. I watched my first League of Legends Season 4 professional match this past weekend.
And you pick up some sweet pointers?
No. I mean, other than the fact that, like, things are really weird now.
And, because like, of the new changes?
Because of the significant changes for Season 4, not only have I had to, like, change how I play and learn, I have to relearn how to watch people play professionally.
Yeah.
Because the strategy is different. Like, now I'm paying attention where they're using special scrying orbs and stuff. Yeah. Things like that.
That's going to be, I think, the big challenge because the ability to change the game is so great on the developers. Like, they could easily just, boop, change a couple values, and all of a sudden the game is hugely changed. Like, I feel like there's less bureaucracy than there is in physical sports. Like, what if, like in the NFL or something, it's like, oh, actually, sorry, you get to kick from, like, the 50-yard line now, you know, instead of... It was a huge deal when they moved the kickoff, the initial kickoff position in football. Like, it's changed the way punts are returned.
Yeah.
But, like,
what
if they did a radical version? Or what if they did that every single season?
Yeah, like, what if Matt Prater always kicked the football?
I mean, it's crazy. Like they could...
Spike pits?
But esports has the power to do that.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to worry about the physical infrastructure, nor do they have to worry about players' unions, nor do they have to worry about TV ratings. Like,
yeah.
They are just so much more free. And with that... with that ability comes so much potential, both like good and bad.
Yeah.
You know,
I know what we have to worry about.
Yeah.
How we spend our time.
That's... Yes. Yeah. That is true. That is true. All right. Anything else?
I think I'm good.
Okay.
You got any others?
There were some little ones like Monaco. I didn't like that game. Everyone seemed to like it.
I liked it. I haven't revisited it though.
Mm. I think that's the big problem. Like, everyone hailed it as this next big thing, and then I feel like everyone got sick of it like in a week.
I think it took too long to come out.
Yeah. I also wrote down that FP game that made me sick, and then I realized it was called Antichamber.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Antichamber.
That game made me sick, but not philosophically. Like, I got motion sickness off of that game, and I had to stop playing.
So that was in my coworker's top three games of the year.
Wow.
Yeah.
It makes me want to play it, but I was, like, sick for, like, an hour afterwards. Like, yeah. It hit me bad.
That game is rough.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, I think what's so interesting about that is it subverts expectations. And that's why I think it's actually interesting. I've seen the Stanley Parable in so many people's games. Even though I think that... what the Stanley Parable is saying is something that's already the norm, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like, so what?
Well, but, I mean, it's something that a lot of people have already kind of confronted after a fashion, either with the first version of the Stanley Parable or just with other games.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like the Stanley Parable made a mark because it hit the scene at a time when Steam is unprecedented in popularity and when more people than ever can play it, and when it is kind of going up against a new generation of consoles, all that are offering very similar traditional video game experiences. Like, I think it, like, hit the mainstream at the exact right time.
Yeah.
You know, for everyone to like it.
Yep.
But, yeah. Okay. See, God, that podcast was so much more interesting than our Game of the Year podcast. Like,
well, geez.
I mean, I you know, we're our harshest critics, but, like, it's, I don't know. This is why I sometimes play games that I dislike.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And, you know, to be fair, I think the games that we selected aren't perfect.
Yeah, not all of them are bad. None of them are just flat out bad.
Right, yeah. Right. But there's something about those games that you just can't get out of your mind.
Yep.
And those are going to be there for a while until they're replaced by the next game I can't get out of my
GTA
mind.
GTA 6.
GTA... in 2016.
Post-apocalyptic story, The Last of Us combined with GTA.
I'm going to go ahead and predict right now. I think the next game we can't get out of our heads is going to be Watch Dogs. Because I don't think it's going to be great.
Interesting.
I mean, maybe I'm just a naysayer.
No, I feel you. I think it's going to be very similar to how we feel about Assassin's Creed.
Yes.
But like the themes of it will be different.
Yep.
Good prediction of not Goaties of 2014.
Yes, come back in March when we sort of kind of think this game is interesting and might be worth your time.
All right, everyone, we'll wrap it up there, but experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And you can give us our goatee by visiting experiencepoints.net and leaving us a review on iTunes. 'Tis the season for giving presents. Yeah, that
so
is
precious,
our presents.
So precious little.
Share experience just with
stars.
Your friends.
Yeah. All right, everyone, thanks so much for listening. We'll be talking to you next week.
Bye-bye. Every time.